listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Bob Cleveland, CEO of Rebuilding Together Southern Nevada. The organization recently announced that it's receiving increased state funding, which will significantly reduce its wait list. Bob, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So for those who aren't familiar, what is Rebuilding Together Southern Nevada?
We're a local nonprofit that provides critical home repairs to low-income homeowners that are either disabled, veterans, or seniors.
When was it first founded?
31 years ago. We just had our 31st birthday.
Nice. Okay. So what services specifically does it provide for the community members that you mentioned?
We target things that are critical to them living in their home, such as their air conditioner, their roof, their water heater, accessibility modifications like accessible showers, safety issues like broken windows or non-operable doors. It's a pretty wide range, but whatever it takes to make sure you live in a safe and healthy home, is that's our goal. That's what we want to take care of. That way you can stay in your home, age in place safely, and not end up in senior apartments or assisted living, taking up another affordable housing spot.
Okay. How do these homeowners apply for help from Rebuilding Together?
They generally give us a call, and we take an application for them over the phone to pre-qualify them. And then we have our inspection team go out. That's two people, and one will inspect the home and find out. They do a complete 25-point checklist of all the major components of the home. Obviously, we're generally there for a specific reason, whether it's an air conditioner or roof. And then the other person of the team will take all the client's income information and make sure that they qualify according to HUD standards.
Okay. Now, beyond the individual homeowners who you obviously make a difference for, how does Rebuilding Together Southern Nevada improve the community overall?
That's a really great question. You heard me talk about affordable housing real quick. So obviously there's an affordable housing crisis in Southern Nevada. Every one of these homeowners is living in what's considered an affordable house now. Since they're low income, their house is affordable. If they get displaced because they cannot live in an unsafe home, they don't have air conditioning, or the roof is falling in, or what have you, an investor is going to come in and buy that home and fix it up and put it on the market, and it's no longer affordable housing. So we lose that affordable housing piece. And then they're going to go into assisted living or senior apartments or low-income apartments or what have you. And now that's one more of those off the market. So every house that we preserve and every homeowner that we're able to keep in their home, we preserve two affordable housing units. And when we're having a shortage of almost, I think it's 80,000, over 80,000 now in Nevada, every single one counts. And that's how we're doing our part.
That's awesome. Now, you've just received some new funding. Where did the funding come from?
This was leftover, I'm not sure if that's the right word, ARPA funding that other nonprofits were not able to spend in a timely manner. And we had already spent all of ours completely down, and they knew that the need was there. So the state went ahead and transferred that money over to us. It gave us an additional $1.5 million. And we're going to be able to continue to attack our waiting list and get as many people served with that money as we can.
How long is the waiting list typically?
It depends on what part of town you're in. You know, obviously funding's different in the city of Las Vegas, city of Henderson, city of North Las Vegas, and unincorporated Clark County. And the need is different also in those places. The waiting list in the city of Las Vegas, I believe right now is 47. Unincorporated Clark County is over a couple hundred. North Las Vegas is over 100. Henderson's is relatively low, but the way that they fund us, we just are able to take people as they come and get them knocked out before there's an actual wait list.
Okay. How much do you think this new funding will allow you to shorten that wait list?
I think it'll knock it down a little bit, but it seems like the more funding we get, we find there's more need. The word gets out, more and more people are qualifying every year. There's more and more need here every year. COVID really exacerbated everything, really shined a spotlight on safety in your home. You know, we've required seniors to stay in their house when they didn't have an air conditioner. So we really got to see the impact of that. And ever since then, the numbers just continue to climb. We used to only do about 150 homes a year, and we're on pace in this fiscal year we're in right now to do over 1,500.
Nice. What kind of help do you look for from community members who might want to get involved?
We really love our corporate partners. NV Energy is a big one. They come out twice a year and they volunteer. They'll adopt one of the houses that we've already replaced a roof on, and they'll go ahead and adopt it and do non-critical things like painting the outside of the house, cleaning up the yard, removing debris, things that are important, but we can't pay for with our money. We have dozens of corporate sponsors that make those adoptions once or twice a year. We have our biggest corporate donor is Credit One Bank. They're just an incredible partner for us. The amount of money that they put into what we do. And obviously the municipalities are huge as well. As far as individual goes, every dollar counts. And we need to diversify our funds as much as we can, because you never know what funds are going to go away from the government or what funds are going to go away from corporations. And we'd like to see individual donors giving, even if it's 10 bucks a month, it adds up. You know, that's $120 a year. And maybe if there's 10,000 people listening to this and they do that, that's I think $1.2 million a year of money that we don't have to go out and raise.
Yeah, absolutely. What about volunteers?
Most of our volunteering is done by corporate teams. So if you really feel the urge for this and it's really touching your heart, I'd suggest you get a hold of the company that you work with and see if you can put a volunteer team together and give us a call and we'll get you set up with a house.
Awesome. All right. So how can listeners find out more about Rebuilding Together Southern Nevada, what you do in the community, if they want to make a donation, become involved as a corporate partner, or apply for assistance if they need that?
You can do all of those things on our website. It's www.rtsnv.org, or they can give us a call at the office at 702-259-4900.
Perfect. All right. So once again, that website is rtsnv.org. That stands for Rebuilding Together Southern Nevada, rtsnv.org. Or you can give them a call, 702-259-4900, 702-259-4900. And you can find out more about what Rebuilding Together Southern Nevada is doing for our community, for low-income homeowners who need assistance in our community, and how you can help out by making a donation if you would like to do that. Of course, we've been speaking today with Bob Cleveland. He's the CEO of Rebuilding Together Southern Nevada. And Bob, I really appreciate you being here, letting us know all of the good work that you're doing in the community, about this new funding you've just received, what it's going to go towards, and the people it's going to help. So it's been fantastic talking to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having us.
After getting my promotion, the time had come to sell our home, so we got an appraisal.
But it was much lower than we expected. Before we had it appraised again, a friend suggested we make some changes.
I put my framed vintage Negro League baseball shirt, our African art, and family photos into storage. And that second appraisal came back much higher.
It's a shame we had to hide who we are to get a fair home appraisal.
A recent study found that Black and Latino homeowners are about twice as likely as white homeowners to get low appraisals. For example, one Black homeowner received an appraisal more than double the original after removing family photos, Black art, and books from her home. If you believe your home has been unfairly appraised because of race or national origin, that could violate the Fair Housing Act. Contact HUD at hud.gov/fairhousing. That's hud.gov/fairhousing. Everyone has a right to fair housing. A public service message from HUD in partnership with the National Fair Housing Alliance.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Lori Kobo, Executive Director of the UNLV Performing Arts Center. The Performing Arts Center is closing its 48th season with two events in March. Lori, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks, Heather, for inviting me.
So what exactly is the UNLV Performing Arts Center?
So the UNLV Performing Arts Center is a self-sustaining unit within the College of Fine Arts here at UNLV. And we are the home for the UNLV School of Music, the UNLV Department of Dance, and the UNLV Department of Theater, also known as the Nevada Conservatory Theater. We manage the space, the three spaces that they all perform in. And then in addition to that, we also present our own series.
Okay, so when you say present your own series, is that still students from UNLV?
No, we bring in usually world-renowned artists from across the globe to be part of our season. And we have now for 48 years, we've been doing that. So sometimes we'll have like the UNLV Symphony Orchestra will back up a soloist, or the UNLV Jazz Ensemble will perform with one of our guest artists. But most often, the artists that we bring in are performing by themselves.
Okay. So tell us about the American Ballet Theater Studio Company performance that you have coming up.
Yeah, so on Tuesday, March the 11th at 7:30 in the Artemis W. Hamm Concert Hall, we're going to be bringing in the ABT Studio Company, which is the American Ballet Theater's young side. Those dancers are between the ages of 17 and 21. And most of them, well, 80% of them will actually progress up to actually performing with the ABT company. 80% of their alumni from the actual ABT company themselves, the big company, the parent company, are from their studio company. So this is like a training program for those younger dancers.
Okay, so is the ABT studio company kind of like a school for the performing arts where they dedicate day in, day out to ballet dancing?
Well, it's not just ballet, it's also contemporary. So it's all forms of dance that they do. So they are training, and the ABT studio company dancers will perform in some of the productions that the big parent company does. It's just that they're the younger side. So even with like our own Nevada Ballet Theater here in town, they have a principal company and then they have their, what they call chorus members. And so they're the younger dancers that are given the opportunity to perform on stage with the principals. So that's kind of the same situation. It's just that it's the big New York company coming in.
Okay. And what kind of dance will they be performing at your show on March 11th?
It will be a mixed rep. So they'll be doing some contemporary pieces. They'll be doing some classical pieces. So you'll get an opportunity to see both ballet work and contemporary pieces as well.
And why is ballet and other classical forms of dance still important as art forms?
Well, I think that everything that has a visual component as far as art itself is concerned is important to our development as human beings. So is not only is dance, because it involves movement and music and all of those things, but also the other group that we're going to talk about, the Mila Guitar Quartet, they're also just as important because art itself is important to our development. And it's important that we continue to promote art for what it is. Watching anything remotely, whether it happens to be at a movie theater because you're watching a movie production of something like Rent or Les Mis, versus seeing a stage production, there's such a difference between sitting in a theater and watching a live presentation as opposed to sitting in a movie theater where you can get up and, you know, you have to go to the bathroom, you need to get your popcorn, whatever. It's a totally different feel. I personally don't like watching any of the Broadway stuff that's been put into film because I much prefer the live environment and what and the emotions that it invokes in me and the experience that it provides me. And that's why live performances are so vital. Same with any of the theater shows that happen to be going on with Nevada Conservatory Theater.
Yeah, definitely. And live performances have a completely different energy as well.
Yes, definitely. And that goes from the performer side as well. So when you've got a performer that happens to be on stage and there's a really live audience that's watching them, that also fuels their energy and gives them an adrenaline rush as well. So it's important on both sides, both from the stage perspective and also from the audience perspective.
Yeah, for sure. So you mentioned the Mila Guitar Quartet and you also have them performing in a show coming up. Tell us more about that.
So that one will be our last show of our 48th season. That one, they're actually really close together. So we hope that we can get people excited about seeing both a dance performance on Tuesday evening, coming back that following Saturday, which is the 15th of March, and seeing some really exciting quartet music performed. I don't think I have ever seen a guitar quartet that quite meshes as well as these four folks do. They won the 2023 Guitar Foundation of America International Ensemble Competition, and they're phenomenal.
Awesome. So you've got the ABT Studio Company on Tuesday, March 11th, and then the Mila Guitar Quartet that same week on Saturday, March 15th?
That's correct.
Wow, that sounds like a great week.
Yeah, it is. It's going to be a lot of fun. And both performances are at 7:30, and both are being held in the Artemis W. Ham Concert Hall. So once you find it for one, you found it for both. So it definitely is our premier venue when it comes to the stuff that we promote. But like I said, we also have two other spaces that are our laboratories for our own academic units.
Nice. Now, what's unique about the performance style of the Mila Guitar Quartet?
It's unique because most guitarists are either solo artists or they perform with an artist that plays the flute or is a vocalist. Rarely do you see ensembles that will be two guitarists that play together. And really rarely do you see quartets that blend and mix as well as these four young folks do. And I call them young because they're younger than me. But, you know, it's not like they're teenagers. But they have such a unique mastery of the guitar itself and the pieces that they will play, which will range anywhere from classical stuff that like Clair de Lune they might play, which you will find on their YouTube channel. But they are just, the way those four guitars sing together is amazing. And the vocalization between the artists, and I don't mean vocalization in the sense of our voices, but the guitar's voice and the way they blend together is amazing.
So the type of music that the guitar quartet plays is primarily classical?
Yes, that's correct.
Awesome. So where can listeners go if they want to learn more about, first of all, the UNLV Performing Arts Center, also the American Ballet Theater Studio Company performance, and the Mila Guitar Quartet performance that you have coming up, or get tickets to either event?
Yeah, so if you are interested, go to our website, which is pac.unlv.edu. Once there, you will be able to see all the tickets that we happen to have on sale for any number of events, because those aren't the only things that we got going on. And you'll be able to see information about our venues.
Perfect. Okay. So once again, the website is pac.unlv.edu. PAC stands for Performing Arts Center. UNLV is, of course, UNLV. pac.unlv.edu. Now, once again, they've got the American Ballet Theater Studio Company performance coming up on Tuesday, March 11th at 7:30 p.m. And the Mila Guitar Quartet is the final show of the 48th season. That's happening on Saturday, March 15th at 7:30 p.m., both of them in the Artemis W. Ham Concert Hall. And sounds like two amazing performances to close out your 48th season. And we've been speaking today with Lori Kobo. She's the executive director of the UNLV Performing Arts Center. And Lori, it's been fascinating. I actually didn't know that we had this amazing performance arts center right here in town, bringing these types of performances that, you know, just introduce people to a whole new type of experience that they can't really get anywhere else around here. So I really appreciate you being here and sharing with us. Thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you, Heather, for having me.
What's the biggest myth about interscholastic performing arts? That you have to be the most talented or experienced to participate. The truth is, anyone can be a part of their school's performing arts. There are countless opportunities for students to participate, from theater, choir, and band to speech and debate. The bottom line, if you want to perform, there's a place for you.
This message presented by the NFHS and the NIAA.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and joining me is Dr. Donald Middleton, professor of family medicine at the University of Pittsburgh. We're currently experiencing a surge of respiratory viruses, and seniors are just one of the demographics at greater risk of becoming seriously ill. Dr. Middleton, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you, Heather. Thank you for speaking with me.
So what is the current situation with respiratory viruses?
Right. We're in a bit of a plague here from three viruses giving us trouble at the same time. The three viruses are well known to most individuals, and they include COVID, which never really went away. It just got to be less frequent. Influenza, which comes almost every single winter, and there are three different kinds of influenza going around this year, although most of them are H1N1. And the third virus is respiratory syncytial virus, which is known as RSV by its initials. At the same time that these three viruses are giving us respiratory problems, we have a fourth virus, which is causing gastrointestinal issues, nausea and vomiting, and that virus is called norovirus.
Who is most at risk of not only catching these viruses, but becoming seriously ill as a result?
It was sadly, everyone is at risk of catching the viruses. It's the outcomes that you mentioned about the seriousness of the infection that matters. So the CDC and almost all medical societies recommend that everybody age 6 months or older get a flu vaccine every year. The CDC and medical societies also recommend that everyone age 6 months or older get a COVID vaccine. And that COVID vaccine may vary in time because COVID doesn't go away. It's not as seasonal as respiratory syncytial virus or influenza. So you can get your COVID vaccine at any time, including now, if you haven't had one. And that should be given to everybody age 6 months and older. Older individuals, people 65 and older, are at higher risk from these three viruses. And actually, respiratory syncytial virus kills more elderly patients than it kills children. And influenza and COVID and RSV can also leave individuals with conditions that occur as a result of being infected, things like mental confusion, long COVID, or fatigue that keeps people from recovering quickly, or following flu, a heart attack, or a stroke. So if you're an older individual, you really need to pay attention to these three viruses for which we have a vaccination, RSV, COVID, and influenza, and make sure that you are up to date with those vaccines. The issue with norovirus, sadly, is that we don't have a vaccine to prevent it. And so for that virus, what you need to do is when you touch someone who is ill, wash your hands and then don't touch your face.
Okay, so you mentioned that seniors are at higher risk of getting a serious illness as a result of one of these viruses, 65 and older. Yeah. Who else might be at higher risk of developing complications?
Well, sadly, individuals with underlying health conditions that put them at increased risk, things like congestive heart failure or diabetes mellitus, or individuals who are being treated for a serious illness like cancer, those who have immunocompromising conditions, or simply something like asthma will put you at increased risk, or COPD will put you at increased risk. So some of these vaccines are available for younger individuals who have those conditions. But for example, RSV vaccine is to be given to people age 75 years of age and older, regardless of what else is going on. But if you have something like an underlying medical condition like diabetes, it can be given to people age 60 and older. So you just need to speak with your healthcare professional and ask them, you know, am I in the group that needs to get this vaccine?
Okay. But as a rough guideline, seniors and those with chronic illnesses are at most risk of becoming seriously sick.
That's true. But every year, people who have no underlying conditions also die from these viruses. And sadly, they can be the conduit for transferring the virus to another individual. The best way to avoid that is if you become sick, put a mask on, or if you're in a situation where there is a lot of potential for individuals to have disease, like if you're going to a crowded auditorium or something and people are coughing, then carrying a mask with you and putting it on if you're close to one of those individuals is also a benefit.
Yeah. Okay. Are there other tips that you would recommend for people to lessen their chances of catching a virus in the first place? Meaning, you know, lifestyle, diet, healthy things that they can do?
Absolutely. The best thing to do is to watch your weight. Don't smoke. All doctors hate smoking. Even some doctors who smoke hate the fact that they smoke. So don't smoke. Try to avoid vaping, which may damage the lung. And make sure you diet and exercise. And then lastly, get a good deal of sleep so that you're well rested during the day. The sleep actually does help the immune system function at an increased and better level. Now, I want to make it clear that all of those things are important, but the most important thing to do is to get a vaccine, particularly against COVID and influenza, and if you're old enough, against RSV. And those two vaccines are given to everybody age 6 months and older. The uptake, sadly, in the U.S. is poor, and the result of that, sadly, is that currently 30% of our patients in the emergency department have influenza. 30%. It's just unbelievable. And the statistics are that somewhere in the 90 to 95% of people who die from COVID haven't been vaccinated with the most recent COVID vaccine, which came out last September of this past year. If you are 65 years or older, you need to get a second COVID vaccine now because your antibody levels may not be protected any longer.
Now, besides talking to our primary care provider, where can listeners go to find out more about the current respiratory illnesses and their prevention?
Right. I'm speaking for Moderna, and they have a great site. It's called For You and Them, all one phrase, .com, foryouandthem.com, to get information particularly about things like COVID vaccine. The CDC is still functional in terms of giving the lay population information about any one of these four viruses with which we are currently dealing. If you put RSV CDC into a search engine, when you open that up, it gives information for the lay population and avoids a lot of medical jargon.
All right, perfect. So once again, you can find information from the CDC. If you Google RSV and CDC, you get targeted information. You can also check out the website foryouandthem.com. That's foryouandthem.com, put out by Moderna. And we've been speaking today with Dr. Donald Middleton. He's the professor of family medicine at the University of Pittsburgh. And Dr. Middleton, I appreciate you being here and bringing us up to date on the current situation, the current guidelines, and ways that people can keep healthy during this time of year. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
If you're 19 or older with certain underlying medical conditions such as asthma or diabetes, you can get vaccinated against pneumococcal pneumonia, a potentially serious bacterial lung disease that can disrupt your life for weeks. If you're 65 or older, it is also recommended you get vaccinated against pneumococcal pneumonia, no matter the season. Talk to your doctor about vaccination today and learn more at lung.org/protect yourself. A message from the American Lung Association in collaboration with Pfizer.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Pamela K. Gavin, CEO of the National Organization for Rare Disorders. February 28th is Rare Disease Day, but rare diseases aren't actually that rare. Pamela, thank you so much for being here today.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Heather. Thank you for having me.
So what exactly is the National Organization for Rare Disorders?
The National Organization for Rare Disorders, which we fondly refer to as NORD for short, because it's a mouthful, is a nonprofit patient advocacy organization that was established over 40 years ago by patients and parents and clinicians and other advocates living with rare conditions to advocate for a better future, better access to healthcare services and treatments to serve rare diseases.
Now, how common are rare diseases?
Individually, rare diseases are rare per the definition of 200,000 people or less with a particular condition. But collectively, they are not rare, which is often misunderstood by people. Actually, 1 in 10 Americans, that equates to 30 million people in the United States, live with a rare condition. It's more than the population of Texas. And while each of those 10,000 individual rare diseases are rare, collectively, as I said, they're not uncommon and they affect everyone. With 1 in 10, they affect, you know, your neighbors, your friends, your children's classmates, your coworkers. So they affect everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we've just observed Rare Disease Day. Why is it so important?
Rare Disease Day is an important initiative. It's an awareness day that's global. It's a movement highlighting the challenges that rare disease communities face behind every rare disease statistics is a real person and a family navigating a really tough journey. It's a journey that I'm very familiar with. My nephew was born with a rare condition and diagnosed at 2. We lost him at 9 because no treatments existed at the time. And it's a reality that millions of families face every day. So Rare Disease Day is about showing up for these people so they know they're heard and they're seen.
Yeah, that's definitely important. What is your Living Rare study?
So because we know so little about how these conditions affect us in total, we have established a study called Living Rare, where we are looking at a critical gap in understanding, as I said, what it truly means to live with a rare disease. And this study, the Living Rare study, is the first major effort to track patient and caregiver experiences over time to give us the data we need to push for better policies, treatments, and support system for the people living with rare conditions. It will help us shape the future of rare disease care. And it's why we need so many people as possible to participate. The more voices we have, the stronger our case for change, and the more we can help the public relate to the struggles, hopefully build empathy and support.
Yeah. Beyond that lack of knowledge, lack of awareness, what are some of the most significant barriers that affect rare disease patients?
So what we hope to quantify with this study are the challenges that people face. People are often misdiagnosed. Imagine waiting 5 to 7 years for a diagnosis while your health or your child's health worsens. The lack of treatments. Only 5% of rare diseases we're aware of today have the treatments that have been approved for the FDA, which is a struggle for clinicians to offer care for people living with rare conditions. And then there are financial burdens. If you have a child with a rare disease, it's very hard for both parents to be working, and the medical costs are exorbitant. And then limited access to rare disease experts. You could have a condition for which there's only 1 or 2 or 3 people in the country that know and understand your condition. So this is why we need research and policies that consider the unique needs of the community. We need people to recognize that rare diseases impact everyone and to help us create a better future for those living with rare conditions.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's your Show Your Stripes initiative all about?
The Show Your Stripes is a call to action campaign to show up for the rare disease community. It's quite simple. For Rare Disease Day and throughout the year, you can wear zebra stripes, the symbol of the rare community, or share a post on social media with the hashtag Show Your Stripes to raise awareness. The zebra relates to the mascot for the community. Every doctor is taught when you wear hoofbeats, think horses, not zebras, or to consider the more common diagnosis first. But we know they aren't really that uncommon at all.
Yeah, absolutely. Where's the website where people can go to find out more and make a difference?
Yes, you can go to NORD's website, rarediseases.org. That's rarediseases, plural, .org. For more information on how to show up for a variety of activities, joining the Living Rare study, making a donation to research, engaging in education and advocacy initiatives. We welcome everyone, volunteer, support communities across the country and activities that you may live nearby.
All right, fantastic. So once again, that website is rarediseases.org, rarediseases.org. That's the website for the National Organization for Rare Disorders, or NORD. And you can find out more about the Living Rare study and the Show Your Stripes initiative, where you can use the hashtag Show Your Stripes, wear black and white in the photo, and bring awareness to rare diseases, which, as we've talked about, are more common than most people think. We've been speaking today with Pamela K. Gavin. She's the CEO of the National Organization for Rare Disorders, or NORD. And Pamela, I really appreciate you being here to highlight these conditions and what patients are going through. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Heather.
Charlie died after taking a single pill that turned out to be counterfeit.
He was having back issues, and it was a counterfeit poisonous pill.
Websites and social media selling fake medicines may look legitimate, but they're not. Drugs from these rogue pharmacies could have fillers like sawdust or deadly fentanyl.
He died in less than 15 minutes after taking the pill.
Now there's a free tool that can give you peace of mind. At safe.pharmacy, enter the pharmacy web address and you'll know if the site you're using is safe.
If you're not getting your prescriptions from a legitimate source, that next dose you take could be your last.
We just don't want other people to go through what we're going through. It's just horrific.
Go to safe.pharmacy. Find out about fake medicine on social media and if the site you're buying from is safe.
I'm Heather Vail, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Dr. Emily Trunnell, Director of Science Advancement and Outreach at People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA. PETA scientists have recently released a new strategy called Research Modernization Now to End Failed Experiments on Animals. Dr. Trunnell, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I'm pretty sure most listeners are familiar with PETA, but what exactly is People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals?
So PETA is a nonprofit organization that supports animal rights. PETA opposes all forms of animal exploitation and educates the public on these issues.
Okay. And what is Research Modernization Now?
Research Modernization Now is a bold, inventive, common sense strategy to end failed experiments on animals and transition to cutting edge human relevant science. You know, a huge goal of the White House right now is to cut waste, and this is a really obvious place to start, and that's using animals to model human biology. It lays out, you know, the evidence of the decades worth of evidence of failed experiments on animals, including, you know, specific disease areas and why the current system really isn't working.
Okay, so what is the alternative besides experiments on animals?
We have many new technologies now that are actually more predictive of human biology and how humans respond to drugs and treatments than using animals are. So these include things like organs on chips, which are small little devices that you put human cells in, and you can model, you know, the effect of drugs or understand human biology. There's other advanced, you know, methods using human cells, as well as computer modeling, artificial intelligence, imaging. There is just so much we can do now to really understand humans and not, you know, not get a better understanding of mice, which hasn't really led us anywhere.
Now, when you say failed experiments, what exactly does that mean?
So, more than 110 million animals are used and killed in U.S. laboratories every year. But the reality is, and the statistics show, that all of these new drugs that are tested in animals, 95% of them fail when they get to human clinical trials. Another way to look at it is looking at, you know, curiosity-driven research. Most of that uses animals, but yet 90% of the time it fails to result in human benefit. And close to 90% is also irreproducible. And if, you know, anybody who's taken a science class knows that you need to be able to repeat an experiment and get the same results to really kind of show that, you know, you're on the right track. And 90% of the time, or up to 90% of the time, these experiments on animals are not.
With the failure rates being so high, why do they continue to do these experiments on animals?
How long do you have? I mean, it's the answer to that is the answer to also a lot of other questions of why we do things that don't work. You know, you got to follow the money and you follow the opinions of the people who are in charge. You know, most of the people who review and approve whether or not animal experiments get funding are also animal experimenters themselves. And there's this huge industry that profits off the backs of animals who are in laboratories by breeding them or making specialized equipment for scientists to use. And they've just gotten stuck in this rut. And so we found that you really need a legislative or a huge initiative to push people out of that rut.
Yeah, for sure. So how are you going to roll out this Research Modernization Now initiative to benefit animals and improve research?
So we've released a report late last month. It's available at PETA.org/RMN. And we are in contact with a lot of decision makers and have a petition on our website, that's PETA.org/RMN, where people can contact their members of Congress to let them know we want legislation enacted that will enact the research modernization now and end failed experiments on animals.
All right. Fantastic. So once again, that website is PETA.org/RMN. PETA stands for People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. So PETA, PETA.org/RMN. And RMN stands for Research Modernization Now. You can find out more about this initiative to end failed experiments on animals. You can contact your members of Congress to let them know how you feel about it and find out lots more information far beyond what we can cover today. PETA.org/RMN. And we've been speaking today with Dr. Emily Trunnell. She's the Director of Science Advancement and Outreach at People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, or PETA. And Dr. Trunnell, I really appreciate you being here and sharing with us this information about how common these experiments still are and yet how often they fail, which is definitely eye-opening statistics right there. And to your point, you know, there's plenty of other things we can be doing, new technologies that are better suited to what they're trying to answer in these experiments. So I really appreciate you being here and sharing with us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
A dog? I'm not. I was born for a purpose, to bring you hope, to guide you out of darkness, to stand by you as you rediscover life. When past battles cloud your mind, I push them away. You tell me I'm your hero, just as you are mine. You hold me when you're afraid, whisper that I saved you. With me by your side, no challenge is too great, no night too dark. I'm your guide, your companion, your friend, your light. A dog? I'm not. With me, you see the world again.
Discover hope at Dogs, Inc. Visit us at dogsinc.org to learn more.
I'm Heather Vail, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Simone O. Elias, teen author of the new book, Old Films, Young Eyes, A Teenage Take on Hollywood's Golden Age. Some people might say they're old-fashioned, but Simone says classic movies offer plenty of inspiration to young people. Simone, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
So what inspired you to write your new book, Old Films, Young Eyes, A Teenage Take on Hollywood's Golden Age?
I was super into classic films starting around pandemic time, and I saw that a lot of the content being created about them was by older people, specifically older men. And so my friend and I, she had the idea to start a podcast about classic films from the perspective of teenagers. And it ended up being put into a book because I thought there needed to be more young perspectives on it.
Yeah, that's awesome. How old were you when you wrote the book?
I was 14.
That's fantastic. So what is your favorite thing about old films?
My favorite thing right now, it changes all the time, but my favorite thing now is probably the versatility of the actresses and just how many strong women there were in these classic films. And obviously the fashion, too, is really fun. So right now I watch it for those things, but it always varies.
When you say strong women, how does that compare to the way women are portrayed in films today?
I think the way women are portrayed in films today is definitely very different from back then, because back then there were a lot of different standards for women, but they tended to defy them in films more than you think. And I find that women in portrayals today are definitely more sexualized, which I don't tend to enjoy. And so I find that in the 1930s and 40s, they were seen as more of real characters. And now, you know, they sell movie posters with like women in bikinis and stuff. So there was definitely less of that.
Yeah.
And specifically in the 1940s, there were a lot of working women. And yeah, there's just a lot of inspiration that I draw on from that.
Yeah, those working girl films of the 40s, how can they be an inspiration to a modern teenager?
Well, people say it's a long time ago, but in the grand scheme of everything, it really is not. So I think about it like that now. But I find it really inspiring how men were doing most of the jobs, specifically in the factories. And then just really quickly, the women were able to step in and do everything without much training. I find that really inspiring. And then there are a lot of things besides working that the working girl movies have, like female friendship, which is obviously enduring. And so I love those ones. I found that the working girl movies had less men and more emphasis on women, which I always love.
Yeah, for sure. Now, speaking of how the classics can influence people today, how have they helped to shape current pop culture icons, actresses, and singers?
Yeah, I started my book with a chapter called How Classic Movies Are Represented in Modern Culture and Modern Life. And I sort of took it from every different medium. So I started with singers and fashion and just a ton of different things. One of my favorite examples is Taylor Swift and how she has a song called Clara Bow. Clara Bow was a 1920s film actress, and Taylor also drew on 1930s movies for inspiration, like Stella Dallas from 1937, and she acted in a music video as Elizabeth Taylor. So that's one of my favorite examples of that.
Yeah, there's actually, I notice a lot of influence also in, you know, singers like Gwen Stefani, Katy Perry, Christina Aguilera. They borrow that old look from, you know, the classic 1950s movies and that sort of thing.
Definitely. It's everywhere these days, even, what, 70 years later.
Yeah. Now, beyond fashion, how did these golden age movies break boundaries around racism and anti-Semitism?
For anti-Semitism, I wrote a chapter about that briefly mentioned Gentleman's Agreement, which was one of the first old Hollywood movies about Jewish people. And it actually stars Gregory Peck as this journalist who pretends to be Jewish, which would not fly today. But it's an interesting portrayal because he just goes through life as a Jew for this article that he's writing, sort of an expose. And he talks about all the ways that Jews are inhibited from living their daily lives. And then for racism in general, I wrote about Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, which I found fascinating. And it really plays into the race dynamics of the time, like how their relationship is just really interesting. And I found Sidney Poitier's character sort of had to be perfect in order to be approved by the white parents. And, you know, he's a doctor, he's very well-mannered, and if it wasn't that way, I just thought it would be very different. So it played into those sort of dynamics.
Yeah, definitely. Now, you also mentioned that there are classic films that predicted the Holocaust and even the COVID pandemic. Can you tell us about those?
There's a silent film that depicts, I believe, all the Jews being thrown out of Germany. It's called A City Without Jews from 1924. And I was shocked when I learned that. And then the pandemic one, I wrote an entire chapter on because it was fascinating. It's a movie called What's So Bad About Feeling Good with Mary Tyler Moore. And it's from 1967. And it sort of depicts this toucan that comes in from a foreign country, and it's actually China. And it comes into New York City, spreads this virus that makes everybody super happy. They do masking protocols, vaccine protocols, social distancing. It's really uncanny. It's crazy.
Yeah, wow, that sounds awesome. I love Mary Tyler Moore. I'm going to have to look that movie up.
Yeah.
Now, how have classic films predicted current trends around divorce and relationships?
So in the 1930s, before the Hays Code was enforced, it was a whole code of you cannot say or do these things in film. There was a whole era of about 5 years we call pre-code now. And I find that the dynamics in that era really are very modern, specifically the polyamory that is depicted. There's entire movies where those kind of relationships are completely normal. People go on dates while they're married. I found that fascinating. And then divorce, people got divorced a lot in those movies. Women could be free. It was very interesting.
Yeah, for sure. Now, in the 1930s, we had screwball comedies. Today, we have rom-coms. We have TV sitcoms. What's the line between those two eras of comedy?
Romantic comedy doesn't change that much. It's an interesting genre in that way, because comedy itself has changed a lot. But romantic comedy always starts with, you know, the characters meeting and then they end up together, right? So I find that there are a lot of different trends, like enemies to lovers, friends to lovers, the one where they're stuck together. Like, there's a ton of different things that just really originated in classic Hollywood with those screwball comedies. Specifically, It Happened One Night from 1934. That movie has almost all of the tropes we see in romantic comedies today.
Yeah, good observation. What do you think went wrong with Westerns?
Oh, man. There's a lot of things that went wrong with Westerns. I never could get into them. My whole book is about my perspective personally, and it wasn't meant to be an objective perspective, right? Because film itself is subjective. So I know a lot of people who enjoy Westerns. Personally, it's a little bit too much misogyny and racism for me. I don't love movies about the Old West. I prefer different eras. So I'm sure there would be a couple I liked, but I just couldn't really get into it.
Now, when it comes to the actual people who were making these old movies, what are your thoughts on the Hollywood system and how it both made and then slayed the stars?
The Hollywood system was so dominating and controlling during that time. One of the craziest facts I found was that the system would tell you, oh, you're pregnant. You can't be pregnant right now, you know, and then they would go get an abortion. So the Hollywood studio system could actually enforce you and your own body, especially if you were a woman. And they could send you on dates with random men for publicity. They really just controlled you and the way you looked and the way you acted. So in that way, they definitely did ruin a lot of the stars.
Yeah. You've obviously written about a lot of really interesting things, and it's fascinating to read your book, Old Films, Young Eyes. I mean, the title says it right there, but the fact that a young person, a 14-year-old, is looking at these old films and analyzing them with, you know, such a really mature outlook, to be honest. You know, like Siskel and Ebert, you're giving them a run for their money here with your reviews of the movie. So it's a fascinating book. Where can people find out more about it or even get a copy of your book, Old Films, Young Eyes, A Teenage Take on Hollywood's Golden Age?
Yeah, you can just head right to my website, simoneoelias.com, and I have all the information on there. You can buy it off Amazon, off bookshop.org, Barnes & Noble, my publisher, McFarland, all those are good places.
Awesome. Okay, so once again, Simone's website is simoneoelias.com, simoneoelias.com. You can find out more about her book. You can go to her social media from there. If you want to check out the book, it's available everywhere that books are sold, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, bookshop.org. You can get it from the publisher's site, McFarland. And take a look at the website, simoneoelias.com, because there is also more content there to take in. And we've been speaking today with Simone Oelias. She's a teen author of the book, Old Films, Young Eyes, A Teenage Take on Hollywood's Golden Age. And Simone, it's been really fascinating, first of all, reading your book, second of all, talking to you about it. Like I said, you know, really unique take on these things, really great observations and analysis, and I really enjoy reading it. So I encourage other people to read it as well. Thank you so much for being here and sharing it with us.
Thank you.
After I lost my mom, I lost my way. Then I found youth advocate programs, behavioral health services.
As a little kid, I made some mistakes, but I'm not a mistake.
YAP gives communities alternatives to residential care, youth incarceration, and neighborhood violence. After completing our program, nearly 90% of participants remain in their community. YAP works.
I'm working towards a bright future.
Youth advocate programs. Others talk social change. We make it happen. Learn more at yapinc.org.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the Valley. The Nevada State Contractors Board is holding its annual Hammers and Hope event in honor of National Women in Construction Week next Thursday, March 6th from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. in the Whitley Lounge at CSN's Cheyenne campus. Find out more at nscb.org. nv.gov. That stands for Nevada State Contractors Board, nscb.nv.gov. Home Aid of Southern Nevada, the nonprofit arm of the Southern Nevada Home Builders Association, is holding its annual Trivia Night fundraiser next Friday, March 7th from 5 to 10 p.m. at the Water Street Plaza in Henderson. All proceeds go towards Home Aid's mission of helping people at risk of homelessness build new lives through construction, community engagement, and education. Get the details and register to play at homeaidsn.org. That's homeaidsn.org. Monday's Dark with Mark Chinook is a bi-monthly musical fundraising party at The Space, with each event raising $10,000 for a specific charity in 90 minutes. Upcoming shows include Monday, March 10th at 8 p.m. benefiting Life by Music, and Monday, March 24th at 8 p.m. benefiting Care Chest. Get tickets or find out more details at mondaysdark.com. That's mondaysdark.com. And the 7th Annual Walk for Friendship Las Vegas Fundraiser, Walk, and Community Carnival is happening on Sunday, March 30th, with check-in at 10 a.m., welcome ceremony at 11 a.m., walk at 11:30, and carnival from noon to 2 p.m. at Las Vegas Sports Park, 1400 North Rampart Boulevard. Support the Friendship Circle's efforts to provide social and recreational opportunities for children and young adults of all abilities. Find out more or register at walkforfriendshiplv.com. That's the number 4, walkforfriendshiplv.com.